This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alec Baldwin, has starred in such films as The Hunt for Red October, Glengarry Glen Ross, The Getaway, Outside Providence, Staten, Maine, and Pearl Harbor. He's in the new film, The Cat in the Hat. Last week, Baldwin won this year's Best Supporting Actor Award from the National Board of Review for his performance in the new film, The Cooler. His character, Shelley Kaplow, runs an old Vegas casino. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott wrote, quote, Shelley is both a brute and a sentimentalist, and Mr. Baldwin swivels elegantly from viciousness to self-pity, from utter rottenness to something that might be mistaken for nobility, unquote. In the film, Baldwin's casino partners think he's out of touch with the times. They've sent in a new guy who wants to run the place and given a makeover. Here's the new guy, played by Ron Livingston, in a meeting with Alec Baldwin.
Shelley, I want you to know that I have nothing but the utmost respect for you. You've done a tremendous job with the Shangri-La over the last 16 years, and I don't think anybody can dispute that.
Yeah, nobody doubts that, Shelley.
But the business has changed. Just take a look at the Strip. You see what I'm talking about.
What? You mean that Disneyland Mook Fest out there? Huh? Come on, you know what that is? Huh? That's a f***ing violation is what that is. Something that used to be beautiful. Used to have class, like a gorgeous, high-priced hooker with an exclusive clientele. And then along comes that Steve Wynn f***ing sucker and knocks her up and puts her in a f***ing family way. Now she's nothing but a cheap, fat whore hiding behind too much f***ing makeup. I look at her, I see all her f***ing stretch marks. It makes me want to cry because I remember the way she used to be. Am I right?
Well, there's no arguing the bottom line. Those places are raking it in. And the Shangri-La as she is now can't compete with that.
You think I'm trying to compete with that? You think that's what we're about? Trying to bring in the f***ing stroller crowd, fresh off some f***ing e-ticket ride, trying to break the house on red and black? Fremont has never been about that bullshit. This is where old time and real money come to play.
Alec Baldwin, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you to describe your part in The Cooler.
The guy that I play, Shelley Kaplow, is the casino manager of a very run-down, what they call in the script, an old-school casino. And I guess the easiest way to describe the ethic there is that, you know, when people owe us money, we don't litigate. We take them downstairs and we beat them with a lead pipe. And it's Bill Macy, who plays the title role, is the cooler, which is an old concept of a guy who... In real terms, a cooler was a guy you sent to a table to disrupt the action of someone who was on a run. So I would bump into you or spill a drink or do something to distract you and break your concentration. And in our movie, we have Bill go, and he's just such bad luck. He literally is like a bad luck charm. And when he just goes and stands next to you or touches your jacket or he's even near you, all of your fortunes just dissolve.
Do you know your way around the casino world?
No, I myself am the cooler in my own personal life. I'm just the worst gambler, and I don't really care about gambling, and I always lose, and I never really gamble. I've been to Vegas a couple times, actually to do research for a movie, and I would play blackjack a couple times, but sports books, sports betting, side bets with my friends, I mean, you name it, anything, I always lose every bet I make. So I'm not a big fan of gambling.
Now, in addition to The Cooler, you're also in The Cat in the Hat, which is, you know, a children's holiday film. Being a father, has that changed how you feel about doing a film that is, you know, a family film primarily geared for kids?
Well, my daughter is 8, and sometimes you can do these movies, and by the time you make the decision to do the movie, and the movie is actually released, your child has aged out of the demographic for that movie. So I never really think of my own child. To do films for children at large is interesting to me because, you know, it occurred to me when I did Cat in the Hat that it's such a huge part of the market now. I mean, there are so many films that are made just for kids, and you wind up developing an audience among people that are 5 to 8 years old. I used to do narration for the PBS series Thomas and the Magic Railroad, And then I did the movie, Thomas and the Magic Railroad. And I can't get over how I think I have just as many parents and children comment to me about them watching that DVD or video product at home as any other job I've ever done.
So you're kind of creating new fans.
Yeah, you really are. You're like, you have people who, you know, to me, career-wise, I'm a pretty bad person career-wise. You know, I never really was very good at making this career decisions. And, you know, now I'm older and I've done this for a while and I just think I just want to be in a good movie. And whether the part for me is the most splashy role or whether the part is a real opportunity for me critically or what have you, I don't really think about that much. I just think I'd like to hitch a ride on a movie that I think is a good movie.
Alec Baldwin is my guest, and he's starring in two new movies, The Cooler and The Cat in the Hat. I thought we could listen to one of your great movie scenes, and this is from the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, which is based on a David Mamet play. The movie is about salesmen who are selling this worthless land, but they have to make it seem like this land is really great and you're getting a really great deal. So the people who they sell to are mostly these real, like, naive losers. So you play the manager who's sent in from the main office to light a fire under these guys and to get them to, like, to keep selling. I'm going to play part of your monologue.
Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. You get the picture? You laughing now? You got leads. Mitch and Murray paid good money. Get their names to sell them. You can't close the leads you're given. You can't close shit. You are shit. Hit the bricks, pal, and beat it, because you are going out.
The leads are weak.
The leads are weak. The f***ing leads are weak. You're weak. I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
You. That's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here tonight. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name. And your name is your wanting. And you can't play in the man's game. You can't close them. Then go home and tell your wife your troubles. Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted. You hear me, you f***ing faggots?
That's my guest, Alec Baldwin, in a scene from Glengarry Glen Ross. That scene must have been so much fun to do because, well, the writing is so good. Can you describe a little bit your approach to learning and digesting that really pretty long monologue and figuring out, like, how you want to pace yourself in it, where the pauses are going to be, how dramatic to get?
Well, you know, the doing that film was interesting because the role that I played was not in the play, and Mamet had added that role to the screenplay for the movie because he felt that they needed to be, we needed to see the stakes raised a little higher at the onset of the film. So he added this scene, and we went in there, and it was an enormously difficult and unpleasant thing for me to have to do, because here were these actors who I loved, Kevin and Jack and Ed and Ark, and I had to go in and really just kind of pee all over them. You know, it was just this horrible scene, you know, in terms of if you did it right, you know, you didn't want to back off. And I just didn't want to do that. You know, they were all getting along so well and all had a great time shooting together. And I walked in to shoot the scene for just 2.5 or 3 days, and because we rehearsed a full rehearsal period prior to the shooting, which is very rare. And so we did that, and, you know, you could tell it was going to be really tough, you know, because, I mean, I had to be so nasty to these people. And I left, and, you know, I came back, and they started shooting for a couple of weeks. And it was one of those things where you come to work and they're all sitting around the coffee urn and eating a bagel and laughing and having a good time. And I walk in and they're like, oh, you know, Schmucko is here. you know. And I come in and I got to, you know, they know what's coming, which is I got to just kind of singe their hair all day and play the part. And Jamie Foley, I'll never forget, said to me, well, it's like Patton. And it's like when Patton walks in the tent and slaps the soldier in front of all the other men in the medical tent and says, you know, you call yourself a soldier and how dare you disgrace this place of honor and everything. And, you know, to Patton, the deepest affront was cowardice. And so we took that image, you know, and I went into the scene like, you know, you call yourself a salesman. I was going to be the Patton of salesmen. And we just ran with it from there. And I just never backed off. And I think to this day, they probably all hate my guts. You know, that's pretty mean to them.
You know, you never got to share a bagel with them around the coffee urn?
I didn't go to the rap party. And they were all very professional about it and everything. But I guess my point is that doing those really tough scenes is not fun. You know, it really isn't fun because to be that person, you know, when you play Hitler or you play Ted Bundy or anybody you play, it's challenging, but it's not really fun. You know, I did Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway quite a while ago, and my friends would come up to me, particularly younger guys, and they'd say, boy, it must be so much fun for you to get up there on stage and get all that out of your system every day. And I said, you know, back then I was 34 years old in 1992. And I said, I realized a couple weeks into the run of the show that I don't have that much in my system to begin with. And that around the second month of the run, I almost wanted to put my arms around Blanche and say, hey, Blanche, why don't you and I sit down and have a drink and try to work this out? You know, let's be friends. And so all of that contentiousness and all of that kind of drama with people, it does wear you out after a while.
My guest is Alec Baldwin. He's in two new movies, The Cooler and The Cat in the Hat. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alec Baldwin, and he's starring in two new films now, The Cooler and The Cat in the Hat. When you started your career, you were, among other things, the young hunk. And I think we know more about how, you know, beautiful actresses, the predicaments they're in and how they're marketed when they're young. We know more about that than we do about, like, the young leading men. What were some of the expectations of you early in your career, you know, as the young hunk?
Well, God, what I wouldn't give to be the young hunk again. It was so much easier. Well, I look at people today, you know, when I first started making films in the mid-80s and then started starring in films in the late 80s and early 90s, it was slightly different than it is now. And, you know, the film business has evolved so dramatically over the last 20, 25 years. And I remember seeing people years ago who were young and who were very you know, attractive leading men and women. And I felt sorry for them because they were so young and they had to learn to act in the white hot spotlight of movie stardom, you know, like Rob Lowe is an example,
mm-hmm.
or Brad Pitt, and people who I thought had good performances in them. And sure enough, Rob Lowe turns around 20 years into his career and does West Wing and impresses a lot of people with his acting ability. You know, for myself early on, mm-hmm. when I was starting out, you really have to make that choice early on. Do you want to be a part of that system? A Hollywood studio filmmaking is something where they invite you to develop you in this way. And if you acquiesce and do whatever they ask you to do, it can be a very thrilling ride. You might not get to act very much. You might not get to be able to perform roles that are that satisfying, but you're going to be a big movie star. You're going to be famous. You're going to have this incredible lifestyle. You're going to be rich. And for many people, that's enough. But for me, I think my early sense of what was good about this business was more theater directed than film directed. I started the first job I did was a soap opera here in New York. And I remember I was on a cast of a daytime soap with a cast where at any given time, three or four or five people were in a Broadway show at the same time. And that was how I kind of got birthed into the business, was surrounded by those people who said the theater was really the only place that you can be satisfied, you know, as an actor.
Well, that soap opera that you were on was called The Doctors. And, you know, I was wondering if being on a daytime soap early in your career helped you or hurt you. Hurt you in the sense that a lot of people, you know, look down on daytime soaps and think that the acting isn't the best and that good acting isn't even particularly encouraged on it. So, you know, that kind of thing might be held against you. People might almost, you know, snicker at a starring role in a daytime soap. On the other hand, some actors say it's just the greatest experience.
Well, I think, you know, it's a variety of things. One, people don't really understand the dynamic of daytime TV, which is that it evolved from radio. And early daytime television up through the 60s and even the 70s was predicated on the same formula, which is you wanted to turn the TV on Monday. And if you turn the TV on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we hadn't really proceeded too far from Monday. You know, if you missed the show on Tuesday and Wednesday, when you came back on Thursday, you could pick up right where you left off.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, every Friday program was where we restated all the facts of what had evolved during the week. So I'd say, you know, Terry, I really am glad that you have taken over Palmer Industries now and that you and Jed are reconciling your divorce. And, you know, there was like a recap, and there's a mechanism to it, which is very artificial, but it was about an audience that is a kind of a come and go audience, you know. And for me, it was a great experience because it's professional experience in the extreme, because you have to show up for work and you have to know your lines and you have to make choices, even though the material is less than wonderful. Typically, you have to do that on a daily basis. So I think it's a great training ground.
My guest is Alec Baldwin. He's starring in two new films. One is The Cat in the Hat and the other is The Cooler. You're known for being pretty political. You've done fundraisers for the Democratic Party. You were the president of the Creative Coalition, and you and it stood up for the National Endowment for the Arts when it was under attack. Do you think Hollywood is more politically divided than it ever was before? You know, on the one hand, there are, you know, a few liberals like you have been very outspoken. On the other hand, you have like Arnold Schwarzenegger is now the governor of California, and I don't know. Do you feel that Hollywood is more politically divided and more more upfront about what those divisions are, that they matter more than they used to?
Well, I think that I think what has happened is that people are a little uneasy because now there's this whole framework out there, this conservative media framework that's going to whip you if you don't speak up too much.
Give me an example of what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, Fox News, I mean, which is, you know, just a joke to me, literally. I mean, although there are good and worthy components of the Fox News operation, you know, there are Fox Sports, I think, is great, and there are individual broadcasters on Fox programming that are honorable. And, you know, I think that what they've done is that they've intimidated a lot of people in my business. I mean, you asked about how divided the Hollywood community is. I think a lot of people don't speak up the way they used to because there's a different kind of consequence now. You know, it used to be that you just weren't as tormented by this network of people, whether it's Ann Coulter or Limbaugh or Laura Ingraham, or you name it, you know, the New York Post Page Six, which is an arm of Murdoch's enterprise, all that kind of stuff. They really mobilize and they really, really attack you and they really, really dissect you pretty effectively now. And some people don't like the heat and they don't like the pain. Well, they don't like it for their children, you know, because they get, kids will, you know, the parents will say, I don't want you to have a play date with this one because of your politics, you know. And I think that people just don't want to be bothered with taking those chances. So a lot of my more liberal entertainment industry colleagues have retreated.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. from the, at least from the media. They'll do their thing privately. They'll go to a private home. They'll write a check. They'll host an event in a private home to raise money. They're involved, but they don't want to get up there in front of the media anymore because they feel that the consequences can be too painful.
Do you feel that Hollywood itself is using politics in a way that it didn't before? I mean, for example, do you think that your political point of view or one's political point of view is taken into account during the casting process or the producing process? If there's a conservative director as a liberal actor unlikely to be hired as a lead, or vice versa, if there's a liberal director as a conservative leading man unlikely to be hired, did you feel that's happening?
I'm sure it does happen. I haven't really experienced it directly myself. I mean, I'm sure, at the height of something, this is what your political opponents want to achieve. You know, when you get, when you go to conservative websites and they're really raking you over the coals about something, and there's a lot of protest about, some comment someone might have made, whoever they are, Streisand or Susan Sarandon or whoever, George Clooney got worked over a while ago. And so they do mobilize themselves, some of these conservative groups, with an eye toward damaging your career. That's their goal.
I know you grew up in Massapequa, Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
And your father was a teacher. What was the subject?
He taught American history and economics.
Would you describe your neighborhood when you were growing up?
Well, it was a real, working class kind of neighborhood. It was real suburban, residential, South Shore, Long Island, and there were people who lived near us, close to the water, that were, more well off. It was kind of a very checkered community that way, and it was, but it was all kids. Everything was about kids. I mean, this is back in a day. I kind of characterize where I grew up and when I grew up as probably the last generation when people who didn't have a lot of money had big families on faith. In my neighborhood, there were a lot of people who the father, had a very modest job and a very modest income of whatever nature, and still they had five or six or seven children,
What do you think your image was when you were in high school?
Probably restless. I mean, I was really like into everything and nothing at the same time. Like, I joined the drama club and I did that for a couple of years and I quit. And then I played football and I played football on the football team, but I wasn't really interested in that. And then I quit. And I played lacrosse and I quit. And I just was like really, really struggling to find out what I wanted to do. And then I went away to college to go to GW to study political science and to go to law school. And I quit. I went there for 3 years and I kind of saw it didn't really interest me. I guess maybe I had, ADD or we didn't have those acronyms when I was a kid. And when I went to NYU and auditioned for the program and got in and I transferred, I began to settle in because I love New York. I mean, that was a big thing for me, was to move to New York City. And that really helped to engage me because I just found out, this is where I need to live. This is where I want to be. And then once I started making films, the acting thing was interesting to me. And it was amusing to me in some ways, but it didn't become really, really great until I started to do plays on Broadway and to do films, and mostly the plays. Actually, I'm doing a play in January. I'm starting rehearsals on a revival of the old Hecht MacArthur comedy, The 20th Century, that I'm doing at the Roundabout Theater with Anne Heche. And we're going to do that on Broadway this spring. And, when I started working on really great material that a lot of thought had gone into, and I worked with great directors, like I did Streetcar with Greg Mosier, who I really just is one of the smartest people I've ever met in this business. And I worked with A.J. Antoon and just a lot of cool people as directors and worked on really, really cool material. And it was fun. It started to become really exciting and fun. And I thought, well, this is who I am. I was always kind of reluctant to say, this is who I am. Even when I was a kid, I said, I don't want to say I'm a jock or I'm a rock and roller or I'm a this, I'm a that. I wasn't quite sure. And then once I started to really feel like I could get my arms around the craft of acting or the art of it and maybe make something of it, I wound up like kind of saying to myself, this is what I am.
When you were going to NYU, I think this is when it was, you were also working for a brief time at Studio 54. And I'm sure as a waiter there, you got to see a lot of happening people behaving in bizarre ways. And I wonder if you learned any lessons there about what not to do in public, or, you know, how not to be if you're on the scene.
Well, by the time I worked there in the fall of 1979, it was all over. You know, no one was really going there anymore. I mean, there might be some people would roll in late at night to just as a pit stop from some other place they were going that was now more, favored. And when I worked there, it was really kind of it was the last gasps, and it closed soon thereafter. Rubel went to prison soon thereafter for tax evasion. And but when I worked there, it was very funny because I just, I was like Jim Nabors, you know, I was like Gomer Pyle. And I'm working at this big disco with all these people, and I go up into the balcony, and some older guy in a beautiful suit would walk up to me and hand me a $100 bill and say, "I want you to go to the deli on 8th Avenue and get me a box of Benson and Hedges in a box. And I want you to get me a lemonade, and I want you to get me," and he had his menu of exactly what he had to have. And it said, "I want you to go get that for me and come back and meet me and Enrique up here, my boyfriend, and I'm gonna, you know, do something nice for you. Okay, run. And I was like, "Yes, sir, I'll go get y'all's candy and y'all's cigarettes and everything. And so nice of you to ask me to do this for you." You know, trot off, come back. The guy would give you like $50 and a tip because he wanted to stay up there and, you know, get it on with Enrique in the balcony all night. And, you know, just make sure that my Brandy Alexanders keep coming. And it was just so bizarre to me because this was my introduction to all the exotic birds of Manhattan.
Oh, an interesting lesson in the class structure.
yeah, right. Go fetch me my drinks. And, it was weird. It was kind of weird at the first, yeah.
Now, also, when you were at NYU, you did your thesis on Al Pacino and method acting?
Right.
What were some of your observations about the method that you had then when you were just at the very beginning of your acting career?
Well, I think that most people feel that method acting is something where you have to introduce and kind of haul into the process all this stuff, whether it's necessary or not. And that's not true.
You mean all this like emotional baggage from
all of the methods, the tenets of the method need to all be hauled in and rolled in, as a matter of course. And that's not true. Even Strasberg and Stanislavski and so forth, but Strasberg in particular said, "You only use this stuff if you need it." The method had these suggestions that were there on an as-needed basis. And I really learned a lot about that. But more in particular, I mean, I learned a variety of things about Al and his approach. But I mean, I think the thing that is the most important to me, because Pacino was certainly one of the reasons I'm in this business, I mean, I just grew up so mesmerized by Serpico and his early films, and just how dynamic and how charismatic he was, and how intense he was, and soulful, and so forth. You know, Brando and Pacino were probably the two most important people to me at that time. Is that Al, to this day, he just takes it very seriously. You know, it's that acting is important and it's very serious. You know, we did Looking for Richard, his documentary about Richard III. I remember when I worked with Al briefly on the film, I just really loved that he was fun, and he's a sweet, funny guy, but more than anything, he's serious about acting. And I like that.
Alec Baldwin, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alec Baldwin is in two new movies, The Cat in the Hat and The Cooler.